And I'm not quite sure whether I would rather chair a panel at 10 o'clock in the morning when there are 90% zombies in the audience, or at 6 o'clock in the afternoon after everybody's had a wonderful day with some brilliant speeches, a lot of good drinking, a very fine film show, and I missed the last program. But either way, it's a hard job to chair a panel when one's being very tired. But we have assembled before your very eyes this afternoon a panel of experts on virtually every aspect of science fiction, with the possible exception of artwork. And our endeavour this afternoon is to level criticisms within the group on science fiction in general and try and arrive at some sensible answers, and to get you to participate with any complaints that you have, either from authors in general, who are represented this afternoon by Jack Williamson, Jack from USA, who is a back-to-back author now with Fred Powell, also on stage this afternoon, representing the publishers, or an author publisher. We have the book reviewer, represented by Douglas Till of the Tribune, the hardcover publisher, Ronald Whiting of Whiting and Wheaton, on my extreme right, your left, depending which way you're looking. John Watson of Mayflower Books, who this afternoon is going to specialise more on distribution of paperbacks rather than an editor of paperbacks. Next to him, Tony Richardson of Penguin Books, who is a selecting editor for Penguin and recently has been largely responsible for Penguin's new science fiction programme. And finally, but not least at all, Chris Priest on my right, who many of you know, who we think is adequately representing you, the readers. And I would like to say now that each of us here are not to be treated as individuals. We are, we hope, answering for the group each one represents. Now, to open the ball, I'm going to suggest that we take the subject of science fiction book reviewing, which in the last few years has increased tremendously in the last year, from 5 or 6 years ago when books hardly got a review unless they were of the caliber of John Wyndham, Arthur Clarke, or John Christopher. But the lesser known writers and the vast majority of the American writers seldom had a book review here. But in the last year or so, shall we say, since Kingsley Amis made its respectful, somebody said two. My mother always calls him Hardy Amis. And she asked me why I don't get my suits from him. But since Kingsley, with other reviewers, have helped make science fiction respectable in the reviewing, it seems to me that some very harsh levels of reviewing have crept in. And in the last few weeks, Chris Priest and I crossed swords over the telephone over bad book reviewing, with no offence to Chris or to other amateur reviewers. And I want to put this subject to the panel as an argumentative discussion, specifically on bad reviewing as opposed to bad reviews. And I propose ending with Douglas Hill, because he will be representing reviewers, and it's only fair that he should know the criticisms levelled against this particular subject. Ron Whiting, as a hardcover publisher, what assets are there in good science fiction reviews, and what are your feelings on bad book reviewing as opposed to a bad book getting its deserts and having a bad review?
Well, do I need a microphone? Can you hear me?
Very well.
Good. Well, the first thing I would say is, in the old American phrase, call me a bastard, but mention my name when you do. It's terribly important in any sphere of publishing, and I think this is perhaps particularly so with science fiction, which, as Ted has said, is coming more and more into its own in recent years. We've become respectable. That we get more reviews. I would like to see science fiction reviewed much, much more as part of mainstream fiction, rather than tucked away as it so frequently is in the Nationals, if they do it at all. A little panel down the bottom, New ASF. I would also like to see it reviewed by people who know what they're doing in a great many cases, and I don't personally in any way to anybody on the panel. Does it do any good? Yes, of course it does. All publicity is cumulative, reviews are important, I think they're increasingly important. The other point was, did I approve or disapprove of bad reviewing as opposed to bad reviews? Well, of course, let's say at the outset the reviewer has a perfect right to say whatever he likes about any book. This is a reviewer's prerogative. But I do think it's an awful pity if a reviewer, as reviewers are wont to do on occasions, pick on one small part of a book, spend three quarters of the review criticizing it, and then finish up at the bottom saying, but on the whole, this is a good book. Now, this really hasn't helped anybody very much, and it happens very frequently. If he wants to tear the whole thing apart, okay, go ahead and tear it apart. But let's be constructive, not destructive in reviewing.
Thank you, Ron. I'm sorry I missed the end of that, because I did get a signal that you weren't being picked up too well on this particular microphone.
No.
But you felt the problem by stopping your conversation. Let's switch to the other end of the scale and ask Jack Williamson what he feels about book reviews. And we have to bear in mind here that Jack and Fred, specifically being Americans, should see this from a different angle, whether American book reviews, by and large, are good sellers of science fiction, or whether it doesn't really matter. Jack?
Well, I might do a comment that personally I've had a very happy experience with a snide book review when one of my novels was first published. A reviewer who said a few more or less nice things about it said that, unfortunately, the writing made it seem like a space comic strip. And the result of that was that the New York Sunday News, the largest paper in the States, telephoned me home in New Mexico and commissioned me to write a space comic strip that ran for 3 years.
Thanks, Jack. I think before I ask Fred's opinion on this, because he's seen it from more than one point of view, being an author and an editor, and I imagine comes under some criticism from reviewers in America. I think I should mention, you probably all know that Robert Heinlein's Farnham's Freehold, recently reviewed here in the press for the last 2 weeks, has in fact had generally very bad reviews. A highly controversial book again, but I'm interested insofar as, in general, they were bad reviews. This particular question I won't put to Doug Hill later, but this may have some bearing on Fred's comments regarding the reviewing.
In the States, it's ordinarily so that science fiction books are only reviewed in science fiction magazines in any detail or with any understanding. When you've got Sky Miller and A.J. Budriss and Judy Merrill giving a response to what you've written, you've had it. There's nobody else who will know what you're trying to do, much less be able to say how well you've done it. The little box at the bottom of the page which says new science fiction books in is about all you'll get in most American papers, and they will usually confine their statement of opinion to a word: good, bad, fair. They reviewed the book of Horace Gold's a couple years ago, twice in consecutive weeks, because they forgot, and one time it said good, and the other time it said terrible. But my feelings about reviews are mixed, not only because of the fact that, as Ted says, I work on both sides of the street, but because I am so vain myself that I don't dare read reviews. If If I like them, they turn my head, and if I don't like them, they send me into despondency for days. So ordinarily, when the publishers send me their reviews, I thank them and put them in a file and never look at them again. And I think that if more writers did this, we'd all be better off, because I have a notion that too many science fiction writers in particular have come to write for the reviewers and for other writers, and not enough for the readers.
Thank you, Troy. I think this is a very fair comment. In fact, from my experience with many writers, they are very much afraid of the book reviewers, although they disagree heartily with most of the reviewing that is done. Now, from hardcover publishing, quite obviously, the paperback publishers must see the books long before they're published in hardcovers. If they're American books, a number of copies are distributed here, or rather they come to a publisher who buys them, and he gets extra copies, and he then passes them to various paperback houses. So that the paperback publisher is not in exactly the same position as the hardcover publisher, who is more or less sticking his neck out and saying, yes, I think this is a good book, I'll take a chance and publish it. Paperback publisher has, in fact, the opportunity of reading the reviews before he publishes the paperback, although he will probably have bought it long before the hardcover edition has been published. Shall we hear from Tony Richardson of Penguin as to whether book reviews, good, bad or indifferent, have any effect on editorial policy at Penguin in general, but let's say paperback houses, and also whether bad reviewing has any specific content in sales of paperbacks afterwards.
I think it has absolutely no influence on editorial policy at all, because it is, I think, invariable that we will see a book before it has an opportunity to be reviewed, before in fact it is published by a hardback publisher. Of course, reviews are good for us, and we're lucky, I think, in this respect. We do tend to command kind of review space, even the reprints, which is perhaps only given to hardback firm who is publishing originals. As far as I can see, the main problem in terms of the quality of reviewing though is this. We as paperback publishers are naturally concerned above all with reviews in popular press and not with reviews in fan magazines. Magazine reviews will affect probably the enthusiasts who are going to buy anyway. They may have read the books in serial form, anyway they'll buy the hardback. Our problem is to sell to an infinitely greater audience than this. So consequently, reviews in the national press are quite important to us. What worries me is that, as far as I can see so far, there are no criteria, no proper criteria being applied to science fiction reviewing. If you apply specifically literary criteria, then you're probably going to miss the point anyway. And yet, no one is quite sure what criteria should be applied. I think this shows up pretty well in some of the reviewing which has gone out over here recently, that simply the literary page editors don't quite know who to give science fiction to. I really couldn't make any suggestions in that respect, but I do think it's a pity. I think it needs distortions, whether they're kind or whether they're not. Because I think science fiction is a different genus from the ordinary novel and should be treated as such and should be reviewed, I think, by someone with a, should we say, with a specialized knowledge or a sympathy to do a proper job.
Well, thank you, Tony. Would you pass the microphone to John Watson? I'd like to ask John whether bad reviews of a book after they have been bought and the editor has accepted them will colour his sales force in doing anything specific to try and alter the scheme of things in selling a paperback.
Yeah. No, I don't think that bad reviews affect sales at all. One of the things that worries me about science fiction as a genre, as a part of our list, is that bad science fiction can sell almost the same number of copies as good science fiction. Somewhere along the line, I think there's a certain an attitude, not only amongst reviewers or literary editors, but amongst people like editors as well. I don't mean Penguin, who are rather special. But I mean, you do tend to see the same names coming up all the time, and very often in more than one list, which means that this is an indication to me of a certain laziness on the part of the popular paperback houses who rely we don't have enough. I don't think knowledge is the word. Sympathy, possibly, is the word. Most editors are not specialists in that sense, but most companies, I mean, they're employed by us as readers, but in the main, and then there are people at companies thinking in terms of general fiction, of non-fiction, of the Western, of mystery, of sci-fi as well. And it tends to lean, possibly, on fairly casual knowledge. This, to me, is a rather sad thing, because I think that you can, by looking at the subscriptions to books which do vary in quality, it's saddening to see that the sort of difference between what is obviously first class and what is, one guesses, not first class. Is that the answer?
Thank you, sir. In other words, really, it doesn't make any effect as far as the distributed stuff.
Well, it's a special problem.
Yes.
The paperback publisher doesn't sell books in strictly the same way as you would. He distributes books. He forces books into our market, into a display space that he has to fight for more and more in this country than what you've been doing in the States for the last 10 years or more.
Well, let's now move to the reader who ends up with the book, which is gone through the mill from the time the author first thought of the thought. The idea behind the story through his agent to a publisher, to a hardcover publisher, paperback publisher, and a distributor, and see what the reader has to complain about with reviewing in general. Is his choice of purchase of a book coloured by a specific reviewer because he likes the newspaper the reviewer writes in, or is he coloured by the author's name, or whether the book may be a bad one, but favourite book? Is Chris Friesen.
A science fiction reader who is sufficiently interested in science fiction can subscribe to these amateur magazines, fanzines. He will probably read them more than the general public who have heard of them. Consequently, he is capable of being able to study the whole field of science fiction reviewing, right from the top, where you get people like King James and Morgan Lee Tulaski in The Observer, down to Joe in the fanzine. If he studies reviews in the medium of one particular work, he'll find a fundamentally different approach to each review. From the point of view of a newspaper, for instance, invariably science fiction reviews are given to an intellectual who would look at the book in a slightly condescending manner. And he would say, well, let's have a look at what the science fiction boys are doing, compare it with mainstream, modern literature, contemporary work, and try and place science fiction within the field of literature. Then you get the magazines like Punch, which have an occasional review. I think it's a chap called Young reviewing Punch. He seems to take a point of view towards science fiction that isn't entirely with him. He seems to miss the point sometimes, but again, that's personal. This is Young personally. And then there's the literary reviews, which have a small circulation to person like Punch. I'm thinking in particular of Books and Bookmen, which has a regular science fiction column by Tom Borden. I don't know if he's here. And then, of course, the fanzine. The fanzines, I don't know how many people here read many fanzines, but I don't think they can be taken, broadly speaking, as any criteria for science fiction reviewing. The main reason is because within the field of science fiction addicts, you get these people who like one certain book and stick to that kind of writing, and other people might dislike a certain kind of deal. Now this diversity of opinions towards science fiction brings about few anomalies in opinions of books as published. I'm thinking in particular of a recent publication by Mike Walcock, which is Stalking Them. This was blurred on the cover. I don't know whether this was a reprinted quote from another magazine or newspaper by David Ballard, who gave this an excellent review. and he spoke in very glowing terms. In Books of Bookman, it was dismissed in one line as cheap space opera. I think this is probably...
Can I ask Mr. Smith's question? What is it? You said someone wasn't with it. What would you say is it?
Somebody's in space off the field.
Well, three different people would be acquainted with the field, but you have different entrance to the field. What would you say?
If you're looking at an example, I think the fellow B.A. Young, who also produces both mainstream fiction and non-fiction work.
No, I think one of the problems is that we keep talking about the quality of the views and so on, but no one could really say, well, what is Ivan falling about in science fiction now? Who is writing it?
Well, Gavin still found.
And who is not?
So I think this is a delicate situation here. One starts naming names, because who is it and who isn't. Jim Ballard, incidentally in Athens, sends his very good greetings to you all and says he's very sorry that he happened to be away on holiday. He really would have liked to have been here. Passing back to Chris, and do anything more to add to it? What you're saying is this not
around. Oh, well, I think it's a great shame that writers have the power of balance should be dismissed as another, just another science fiction writer. This is Ballard in particular, but I think the major point that the mainstream reviewers of science fiction miss is that science fiction is a field within itself and it has so many strata before which it can be judged.
The thing I would like to ask is, do you think that the book is science fiction means that from the...
Use the mic, please.
Sorry. As we said, you think that the fact that a book is science fiction means that from a literary point of view, it is almost automatically going to be devalued. It seems to me this is the implication by the amount of space science fiction gets, shall we say, in the summaries, in terms of review. You'll run through seven novels and perhaps 400 words. And it's something which doesn't seem to me to be justified by the quality of some of the work produced, you know. I mean, do you feel hard done by it because you're a science fiction writer? Or rather, can I ask Fred Paul what criteria perhaps he would like to see involved when someone's reviewing one of his books?
I think it would be a useful trait for a science fiction reviewer to ever have read any science fiction. My impression is that a good many of them have not. One of the reasons why I stopped reading reviews is that it offends me to have a name of a book of mine at the top of a column and my own name as author, and then have the reviewer discuss the works of Ray Cummings and Ed Earl Ripp. And they don't seem to care much what the words say on the page of the science fiction book, as long as they can get off a few jokes about bug-eyed monsters and space opera, which of course are brand new terms to all of them, and I think they're very funny. But I think that the basic trouble with science fiction reviewing is a trouble with all reviewing, and that is that most people would rather not really read about books, and that the space in newspapers to cover news about books is at a great premium as a result. Even those few people in the world, and there are not more than a tiny fraction of the human race who do so, who read books at all, prefer to read them and make up their own minds and don't really care too much about reading someone else's review. If they do read a review, they want it to be brief and to get on with it, and they don't want to hear a discussion of what virtues and failings the work may have, or at least this is my impression of the States. I have a notion that things are at a more leisurely pace here, but I have no personal experience and can't say.
Fred's reference to the one man that I was coming to you in about 45 minutes. Fred's reference to some of the reviewers using bug-eyed monster phrases has been with us, and this I was going to mention back to John Watson, but this is one of the criticisms within science fiction, that there are many reviewers who obviously have not studied the field at all, and most of them only read part of the dust wrapper in the first two chapters and the last, and then write a review on the book, and it's usually a bad one. Quite unheralded as far as I was concerned, I ran across Doug Hill's reviews in the Tribune about 18 months ago, and I was very impressed with them. It took a world convention for us to get together, but I think he's one of the pleasantest critics and reviewers. with us. And I know that we've loaded rather a lot of criticism on reviewers in general, and if Doug feels that he can shoulder some of their responsibilities, I'd like to hear his comments from a reviewer's point of view.
This is a blush that I'm wearing.
No, I really can't feel very defensive for my colleague reviewers, and I'm glad you're using the word reviewer rather than critic. My wife wants to take me down a peg. She tells me, you're no critic, you're a reviewer. But I don't feel defensive simply because the reason I got started reviewing, rather than just buying books and sopping them up, was because I was annoyed sometimes by the, not the standards necessarily, but the approach that many British reviewers take, naming no names necessarily, mainly the kind of approach that puts a science fiction novel in with a group of 11 or 412 novels for which the Sunday novel reviewer has 3 column inches and includes it as a new fiction. In the same paper that there's 7 column inches devoted to all the new thrillers, crime, guns, spies. And this has always irritated me, mainly because I would much rather read 3,000 column inches on science fiction than one on spy thrillers. So I think the most important point has been made, with all due respect to all the others, is that science fiction reviewers, and all reviewers perhaps, approach their subject with a certain amount of sympathy. So I set out to do so 2.5 years ago when I was offered a fairly sizable space in Tribune every once in a while. But the once in a while being defined as when enough books came in, which is fairly frequently, monthly, let's say, but any regular month. So I set out to be sympathetic. And I'm only talking about myself as a reviewer, because I don't want to defend or attack or talk about any other individual reviewer, so bear with me. I set up an optimum prototypical reader, and about so high, and young, and not particularly well off, and a man who perhaps read a lot of other things as well as science fiction, like perhaps books on science, and maybe he was a student, perhaps. But he was the type of person who went around to bookshops and thought, well, now there's about 3,000 new science fiction books, which one shall I buy this week when I buy 2 or 6? And I felt this man might like to know, this is obviously arbitrary, but anyway, might like to know my point of view on which are the most worth putting up money on. So I set out to address this reader. So I'm not worried that neither editors nor buyers nor authors nor publishers nor what have you paid attention to my reviews. I never expected them to. The fact that an author ever wrote me a letter and said, your review has made me change my entire style of writing, I never read it again. So, sympathy. The trouble is, of course, that the wheels of that bandwagon are rumbling off in the distance, and they're getting noisier and noisier, and there are going to be an awful lot of people who may have a lot of reviewing experience behind them, but who have never come closer to science fiction, perhaps, than the trailer to Dr. Strangelove, where they're going to be reviewing science fiction. It's going to be very frightening, and I'm going to have to eventually recommend to my prototypical reader that he subscribe to all the fanzines there are. We can find out what's happening in the ones that I don't mention. Any questions?
Fred Powell. I'm not very well versed in the literary scene in the United Kingdom. In the United States, some of what has just been said here would be incomprehensible to most reviewers, to most readers, because the picture of a science fiction reader waiting for a review to make up his mind what books to buy could not happen in the United States. If only because the reviews are so long delayed. You heard about the leaky rowboat that brings copies of Galaxy to this country. On its return trip, it takes Sky Miller's review copy up to Pittsburgh so that he reviews them about 10 months late, and I don't think we do much better. And since, particularly in the case of paper bounds, they don't stay on sale more than 10 to 12 days at one good month, they're just not there to buy if after reading a review, a reader wants to go out and buy. Of course, you can probably get them in a bookstore, but not every city in the United States has a bookstore. So that, and if you're going to wait for a reviewer to tell you what to buy, you're not going to buy anything.
So let me correct myself. I didn't set out to tell this prototypical reader what to buy. I set out to be another voice. I was set out to indicate my preferences. I don't think I could set myself as being quite so much of a demigod as to tell anybody what to buy. I just tell them what I'd buy and some of the reasons why I'd buy it. I don't have to buy it. It's lovely. I have it for free, as I mentioned some of the other day. It's like being a drug addict and being asked to take part in heroin experiments.
What I meant to ask was, is it possible to get the reviews out here in finite time so that people can find out what's going on before it's actually been and gone?
Probably not in places farther away from London. Where there may even be places in England where there aren't bookshops in every town. But John Watson bought the advance of this one on distribution. I have books more or less on sale in a specific period, certainly longer than 10 days.
Well, it depends on the particular list. England, who's a much stronger sale in bookshops as such, as opposed to the other more popular minds who are more in line with the American method of distribution. We find now that books are on sale for a much shorter length of time than they were even 2 years ago because of the increased production, the large number of titles, with the result that as they come in on the heels of each other, you get them smartly likely to have it sold, let's say, their 3 weeks of life, are on the way back to us. And every bit of that culture works now on a basis of its costs, allowing for something, anything from 7.5% to 17.5% returns of the books that go out. Because again, they're not sold, they're distributed.
So in effect, there is a much shorter time of sale now.
I would say that there is now.
So if a book review is 2 weeks late coming out, and we're talking about paperbacks at the moment, there's a much shorter length of time it's on sale in bookshops for the regular reader to.
Yes.
If he hasn't written.
This is really the other side of the penny to it. We have, in the last 5 years, improved efficiency in digital aid distribution. And people like W.H. Smith have completely modernized the whole approach to selling them, whereas 5 years ago, even, we were selling digital aids in the same way as, roughly the same traditional way as half of the books were sold. This, to a very large extent, now doesn't happen at all. Each publisher attempts to be allocated his space and the best outlets, and he decides himself which books will go in there. And they have a light, and if they sell, that's it, they don't sell them straight back.
I noticed that Tom Goldman had his hand up recently. Tom Goldman, as you know, reviews in books and bookmen. And I'm not sure whether he's going to ask a question or make a statement, Tom.
Hill answered my point. I wanted to first of all state that there is a considerable difference between being a critic and being a reviewer, which Mr. Hill pointed out. That was sort of my main point. The other thing is I would endorse very much his viewpoint, which is that reviewers who know science fiction generally write to people who they feel would be interested in this book. Now, the particular case about Mike Moorcock that was mentioned, I said it was space opera. I'll go down and I'll say it again. It is space opera. That doesn't mean it's not good space opera. But as of adventure, who's got the sword type of book, it's fine. But I feel that the readership for my column prefers a different style of book. I don't neglect it. I still mention it, but I put it down as space opera. I feel that's all a reviewer can do, is to think who he's writing for, and then write for them.
Thank you very much, Tom. Has anyone else in the audience any specific points on this subject? Whether they are affected by book reviews, or take no notice of them, or prefer to read the fan reviews of books?
I'd like to ask you a question.
Otherwise, we're
clearing
the hall.
If I ask a question, the hall will be clear. Could you explain something, please, to someone who is young, naive, and who lives about 200 miles from the London publishing scene? And this is when a review copy of a book appears. Somebody once showed me a review copy, and it said in a review of this book is it is requested that no review of this book should appear before such and such a date. Now, I would just like to know the reason for this, because I can whereas I can see that it won't make the difference of on sales if a book appears, we'll say, on Monday or Tuesday, and it appears the review appears in the following Sunday's Observer, something like that. It could possibly make slight, perhaps, difference on sales to a certain type of reader. With the monthly magazines, or am I viewing this on far too a narrow scope, or what?
You are asking the books that are sent out to reviewers and have a note inside which says the review is not to appear before a specific date, which is the publication date.
Yeah.
You have seen reviews prior to publication date.
No. How does this? Why is this done? Does it not affect sales at all? The public losing interest? Wouldn't it be better if they built up interest with a review and then the book was coming out? Why is this what specification made?
I was going to pass the answer, or at least one answer, to Ron Whiting, but I was going to come in with saying that you must be in a rather unique position if you get books with slips inside which say no reviews before a certain date. I know you're a fan of publishing. You have this. But the ordinary reader wouldn't know when a book was published unless he read the bookseller or a specific journal giving the publication date. Wrong way.
So why do it?
Well, it's partly an organisational problem in as much as the publication date of the book is the date on which the book is published and therefore available to the public through bookshops. Now we're much stronger about this, I believe, than you are in the United States. I think
I would hope so.
This is something which we've had to dig our toes in very strongly about over the years. There are a lot of reasons for it. One very obvious one is that if you see a rave review in a national newspaper for something, and you spend the next 5 days plodding around the Charing Cross Road or Manchester or wherever it happens to be that you live, and every bookseller looks at you blankly and says, no, we ain't got one, you give up and you buy something else. 3 weeks later, the books turn up in the bookshop. A lot of sales have been lost in the meantime. That's one thing. The second thing, again, is an organisational one, in as much as if a lot of people start asking for books before they're in fact available, bookshops themselves, booksellers themselves get confused, they start reordering and so on and so forth. A third reason, and I think perhaps an extremely important one, is that if you're going to have, and I'm talking now in terms of general publishing, which applies to science fiction, but probably applies far more with the big top-selling novel. Now, unless you have some sort of control on this, all sorts of reviewers are going to start creeping out months and months and months in advance, so that by the time the book is actually published, nobody cares anymore. The impact is gone. Now, if I can go on from the general to the particular on this one of the things which worries me more than a little is the way in which American editions tend to drift over here, maybe only in very small quantities, but the people who are interested and the people who care very often get them in advance. They've read them 6 months before the hardbound edition is published in this country. When the hardbound edition comes out, then the reviewer to whom it's been sent says, oh Lord, I read this, didn't I, some months ago? Oh, this must be pretty old hat now. And he goes on to something. Now, this is something which is lost for the author and it's lost to the publisher. This is something which particularly happens, dare I say this, in fanzines. I know the trend is king, I know the trend is enthusiastic. The last thing in the world I want to do is in any way to damp that. By all means, give a bit of advance word that such and such a book is being published in America and we look forward to it being published over here, this is fine. But to spend a page and a half or 3 days, 3 pages tearing it to pieces in some cases, long before it's even seen printed in this country. This is very unfair to the author and to the publisher, incidentally.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Did that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much indeed.
Yes.
Could you please make a few comments on the magazine reviews?
Yes, from which point of view? Aren't there worth?
You haven't said anything about the Bow magazine reviews. You talked about the reviews in newspapers, in a certain specialist magazine, the journals of the publishing world, and about reviews in fanzines, but nothing in science fiction magazines.
Well, let's ask Fred Cowell, who runs a review column in Galaxy, at least, Fred.
I think so, mainly. Main thing wrong with science fiction magazine reviews is that they are so late. I was listening with great interest to the efforts being spent on keeping publishers from putting books out ahead of time in this country. In the United States, the difficulty is to get them to put them out at all, particularly with paper bound, where there are something like 200 new titles issued every month and only space on the racks for 40 in most of the dealers in the country. So that if they get out at all, achieved a great victory and you don't ask for anything else. Also, in the case of paper-bound books, which do comprise most of the science fiction in the States, they are ordinarily printed and shipped to the dealers on the same day, so the review copies will usually reach a man about the time he's seen it on the corner drugstore, and it's a little late for him to influence anyone's opinion. Have I lost the track? I see hands going up.
This might be a question for you, Fred. You have a question for Mr. Powell? No, in a minute.
But the magazine reviews in the United States are small in number because there are so few magazines. Since there are 7 magazines and 3 of them contain review columns, I think they do the job more than one would expect.
Was this an answer to your question?
Yes.
Except
it's not a good
question. I was just asking any sort of comments and remarks.
We might emphasize the fact that production takes a long time. These reviews come out a couple of months after the magazines have appeared on the stands, and the paperbacks are long gone before the reviews appear, usually.
Now this, of course, doesn't apply quite so much in this country, where the 2 existing magazines are printed about 8 to 10 weeks before publication, and they can get late book reviews in probably 6 weeks beforehand. And with advanced copies, it means that very often, and I have seen this happen, the review comes out, and this is what I thought Rob Bennett's question was, the review has actually come out a week or a few days before the book is published. I don't think this is a damaging point. You had a question?
Yes, one of the, I'm too near side, I can't see who it is, but the man on the left made some comments about the British fanzines reviewing and discussing American books which will eventually be published in England. Unfortunately, not all American books end up being published in England. Notable thing is Philip K. Dick's fine novels, as Ted White earlier pointed out. They've been coming out in the United States 2 or 3 years since Man in a High Castle came out in the States, and it still isn't available in England. If the British fans want to read and discuss this, how do they know if they should wait a month or two for a British edition, or if there never will be a British edition?
Oh, yeah. That's a terribly difficult one to answer. I'm not sure how I start to answer it. Have you any ideas on this one?
Well, yes, sir. Part of the answer here is that a number of the books will not be published here by British publisher, but they would possibly be distributed here. But John Bush of Victor Gollancz has his...
Yeah, before he does, I would just suggest there's one very easy way around this. The chap who usually knows the answers on that one is Ken Slater.
John Bush.
Yes, I would like to answer that, because we supply review copies to the fanzines in this country, naturally, but we also keep them informed as best we can of books we are going to publish up to 6 months in advance, so that they know that they can wait for our review.
Thank you. I think this applies in general. Tony Richardson, thank you.
I just wanted to say that we're publishing Man in the High Castle in October.
In fact, we've been a little late in catching up with Phil Dick since I launched him back in 1958 with a serial of his.
hypothetical question to Mr. Pohl. Let's assume that you write a story, a novel, and you're going to submit it to a book publisher. Usually, it'll take a certain amount of time for the publisher to get around to reading your story and decide whether or not he's going to publish it. Of course, it might be shorter since you are a recognized author. But it will still certainly take time before this book finally reaches print and is ready for distribution. Now, wouldn't there be some way of maybe getting the ball rolling to get advanced copies of these books out to the reviewers so that by the time this leaky boat from England comes back to take P. Schuyler Miller's reviews for Galaxy, or Analog rather, that this would be more coincidence?
In case anyone in the back didn't hear him, what was suggested was that the book publishers get out advanced copies before the actual book publication date itself, which they very often do in case of special books. If they have something like, well, I think it was done with Bob Heinlein's Stranger in a Strange Land. No, I know what it's done with. It's done with Judy Merrill's annual collections. At the time when Simon & Schuster was publishing, at any rate, they would send out bound galleys to reviewers roughly 60 days before anyone had books, you see, so they do have an extra 2 months head start. What's wrong with that is that the galleys, bound galleys, cost approximately $7 or $8 a set, whereas the books cost them in the neighborhood of 20 cents. So you see, there's a great temptation to wait for the books.
There's a great amount of criticism in the Amateur magazine. With the exception of this priest, does this have any effect upon the members of your party?
Starting with the wrong point, you would have read reviews when you were at Stop Cinema. Does this have any effect on the fan magazine?
As a publisher, you mean? Do you mean in the way of advance reviews, giving advance information, and therefore enabling us to start getting after things we might not otherwise have heard of from America? Because that would, on the whole, I think, not happen very much.
No, I think the opinions expressed would influence you in any way.
Very little. Let's be frank about it. You know, any publisher has got to back his own judgment, rightly or wrongly.
Tony Richardson.
Yeah. Well, yes, it's about the same situation with us. I mean, you've got to read the book first. Sometimes it's very awful for advance information. Basically, it depends on your own reading of the book, perhaps on an outside report you'll get on the book. But you know your market, and this is, I think, the basic point.
Jack Williams.
As a writer, I'd like to say that I applaud the efforts of people like Jim Blish to apply good literary standards and raise the level of the field and so forth. And even though they're frequently pretty destructive in their comments to writers of my own, I feel that these comments don't affect the sales, that the average reader doesn't much care, that there's a law, sort of like Gresham's law in economics, that the bad tends to displace the good, and so I'm all for these serious critical efforts, even if they are pretty unfavorable or destructive to 99% of most of the science fiction that's being written, because there's always a possibility that this remaining 1% might be better than anyone had expected with a little serious advice and encouragement and so forth.
Can I come back with one comment on that?
Yes. Not particularly constructive, but nevertheless interesting. Talking to Dennis Dawson, I don't know if he's arrived back yet, but talking to him earlier on this afternoon about Farnham's three-hole timeline, which has been mentioned, which I bought for Dawson's when I was there. I think rarely can an SF book have had a pretty overall damning press, quite like this one's had in the last few weeks. And then Dennis tells me this afternoon the book is selling like a bomb. So I don't know what it proves, but it's interesting.
Yeah. So I was right.
You were right.
Painting in Boston, that's all that means.
This is another one of my notes, long range notes crossed off. Everybody's saying the things I've got down here.
Well, I would like to ask Ron Whiting, John Watson, and Tony Richardson, and Fred Pohl, by what yardstick do they measure the suitability of the material chosen for publication? Is it the worth, the commercial worth of a well-known author's name? Is it because they like a particular type of story? By what method do you choose what you're going to publish?
Let me start with the American end first, because he's in the minority.
Well, the first criterion is whether I like the story or not. If I don't like it, I don't buy it. Then if I like it, I try to find out if there is a way I can use it. Quite often I find there is not. As you'll notice, there is one magazine editor here and any number of people from the book industry. This is about representative. There are fairly few magazines and a lot of book publishers. Most science fiction is written for book publishers. Unfortunately, this means that most stories are signed with book publishers before I even know they exist, and quite often there's a publication date on the contract, so that by the time I see them, I've got to engage in a foot race with the publisher to get them into print at all. For that reason, sometimes I can't buy a story, even though I like it very well, because I just don't have time to use it. But the author's name is a greatly overestimated commodity, I must admit, and I hope none of my publishers are listening, because I have discovered, to my own satisfaction, that it doesn't much matter what name I put on the cover of the magazine. The sale will be determined principally by what the cover itself looks like. The cover is of interest to people who want to buy science fiction magazines. It will sell pretty well. If it isn't, I can have Arthur Clarke, Ray Bradbury, Cliff Simak, and H.G. Wells in one issue, and it won't sell.
Can I come back on you, Fred, for a moment then? Using that yardstick then, you could sell trash and get away with it.
I didn't say a word about trash. I said names. I don't think the names...
Yeah, but you said the names weren't important.
I don't think the names are important. I think the quality of the story is quite important, but I don't think the name signed to it makes a great deal of difference. Not in a magazine, it may in a book. I don't know.
Sorry, we have to get the panel to ask the question first. Unless you have one, Fred, on
this. Yes, I want to come back on this, where you say the big importance is the cover. Say, for example, you put out one that had a fantastic cover, really caught everyone's eye, and you had nothing but trash in it. Do you think this would affect your sales hereafter?
It certainly wouldn't affect the sales of that issue, because no one would know until after they bought it.
Future issue.
And it's very hard to know what it would do on future issues. In science fiction magazines, the readers, there are, for every 100,000 people who buy one issue of a science fiction magazine, there are 900,000 other people around who buy them sometimes. That's another way of saying that there's a great turnover in sales. If I put out 12 issues of a magazine like It a year, the people who read the January issue will not all of them buy the February issue. Those who bought the February issue will not all buy the March issue. Some will buy the January, March, and May issues and never look at it again. Some of them will buy it when they see a cover they like. Some of them will buy it at odd times. There is no... The same people are not always customers, and therefore you can't always tell whether they are affected by what they read before, because it may be 6 months before they come back again and they've forgotten whether it was good or bad.
On Fred's side, as an ex-editor, I can add some other comments on this, because a number of years ago we were thinking in terms of this same problem at Nova, with fluctuating sales, and Graf was very sharp at times for an unknown reason, so the managing director of the company decided to try and analyze why certain issues sold well, and the next month there was a big dip in sales, and taking into consideration hot and cold weather, floods, national disasters, we laid up all the magazine covers for 2 years and took sales graphs for each issue, and also annotated the lead stories and the names we had publicized. And after about 3 weeks of doing this with a number of other people in the art department, we came with no answer at all. Just nothing to prove what sold magazine.
I think we're digressing, but there's just one story that I'd like to tell. Some of the American fans may have heard it before, because I think Lester's already told it on himself. When he was editing a magazine called Science Fiction Adventures some years ago, he was asked to prepare an issue, a cover for an issue, in a hurry. He wasn't quite ready for it, and he hadn't decided what he was going to run. But he knew he was going to run a story by himself under a pen name, so he put his pen name on the cover. It was on the cover, and he bought something out of the slush by a man no one had ever heard of named Snodgrass. So the lineup on the cover was Van Lin, Moskowitz, and Snodgrass. It was the best sale of any issue he ever had. Robert Shankly, who had just begun to think of himself as a pretty successful writer at that point, was in the same issue. Robert Shankly tripped it into a magazine stand, picked it up, found a story of his own inside, looked at the cover and said, Moskowitz, Van Lin, Snodgrass.
We pass out as a original question to Tony Richardson of Penguin, because Penguin have been buying, as you will know, in the next 2 years, fairly heavily.
Yeah, well, it's, basically it's a question of what you love personally. If you're in doubt about a thing, you'll get a check read from someone or other. Fundamentally, I think it's a question of personal taste. We are influenced, of course, by, should we say, past performance of an author on our list. But this would usually be, I think, in terms of the amount of money we ourselves would pay for a book, rather than in terms of our preparedness to take it if we liked it. The third thing is that sometimes you have to buy a so-so book, a book you like, that you're not really wild about, because you know the next one's going to be very good, you don't want to lose your option on it. But I mean, the basic thing which determines it is just whether you like the book or not, and the criteria you apply then are really highly personal criteria. You try to be as objective about it as possible, you try to not to have preferences as for particular genres of science fiction. But ultimately it's just, you know, lock it on there. Is that any help by?
Well, before I pass it further along, Harry Harrison was making wild science. Harry.
Is that all I'm in the house? Well, I'll tell you a story for
you. I've got one about you anyway.
No, this is a Pat and Fred Paul story. We like it together. You may recall a magazine called Avon Fantasy Reader. The first issue and the second issue both contain open tombs and things crawling out of oozing slime, green tentacles. They sold yay number of copies. Third issue, somebody had an idea, and a tomb cracked open, and the things came out oozing slime with tentacles, and grabbed a nude girl, and the sales doubled.
Now, that's all. Thank you, Harry. John Watson, who wanted to tell you a comment on that. Almost forgot my original question, but if I remember rightly, I think that I'm buying names rather than...
Yeah, I do believe that names do come, certainly come with us. We've proved that. You were asking, I think, are our considerations mainly commercial or are we concerned with the quality of the story? Well, I think they do relate. A good story is commercial. Then to the good story you must apply good output, good level of production, efficient sales force, that all works. But they both relate. I mean, if you have a list which has a reputation for, say, science fiction, you must guard this reputation very, very carefully. Otherwise, you will find that your subscription of future titles will go down.
Well, I'm coming pretty much at the end of the line, and most of what I would have said has been said. But I copied out something the other day, so I knew it would come in useful tonight. I think it is applicable here. I've written something by Fritz Leiber. He said, a real science fiction enthusiast has to be a little crazy and a little sane, a little dreamy and a little skeptical, a little idealistic, and also a little hard-headed. I think this is probably, on the whole, particularly the hard-headed bit, is true of publishers too. When I first started in publishing, a very distinguished publishing gentleman said to me, when you're looking at a typescript, or a book, or whatever it might be, with a view to publication, first question, when you finish reading it, to ask yourself is, who are you going to sell it to? And I think this must be the first prerogative of a publisher, unless he happens to be very rich, or have a very rich uncle, or happens to be making so much money that he can afford to publish for other reasons. Criteria, does one look for names? Yes, of course one looks for names. If I were offered the top six science fiction writers, don't ask me to name them, tomorrow I would do my utmost to buy them.
But
of course.
Would you buy them irrespective of the quality of the story submitted?
I thought of the dogs in a very bad high mind, didn't I? Because high mind is a very good name and has written some
some very good books, and I believe that he will write some other very good books. Sometimes one has to do this.
So you buy the names, not the stories?
In that particular instance, yes, I'm afraid that's true. It's also true, of course, that one buys unknowns, in which one knows that one's going to lose money. Because the story is good, because it's well written, and because we feel that the author is going to get somewhere on the second, third, or fourth novel.
And also Fred Talbot, Barton's Freehold, if you remember. I have a story here too that ties in with this, and my reflection on Tony Richardson, because it's a Penguin story, and it goes back to our old favourite, Death World.
You mean Harry's old favourite?
Harry's old favourite, yeah. He hasn't been advertising Death World 2 very much because he's in the middle of writing Death World 3, I hope. But before Tony Richardson's time, Death World was accepted by Penguin, by a previous editor, and went along the line 2 years to production. And then there was an editorial change and a new editor came in and read the existing list and came to Harris and said, "Good God, we can't publish that, cancel it. You know, we'll even forego the option, the advance on it." And he went down the line. Unfortunately, they found it had gone to production. So, very reluctantly, they decided they would go ahead with it. Did you know the story happened? They didn't. And, of course, it came out, and in the month of June, it was in the top 10 best paperback sellers in this country, which was most unusual, because the only other one that ever got in the top 10 best of any magazines, not just science fiction, was John Wyndham's collection of stories. The previous year. We've only ever had two science fiction books listed in the top 10 best paperback. But this was a Penguin gap that came off successfully. Chris Priest.
I'd like to reverse the order of things slightly, just for a second, and ask Mr. John Rush for Lance. In the last year, you published a novel by chapter Leonard Davenport. On this question, can I ask you how the sales of this book compared with books by better known authors?
Yes, I'll answer that. He did, I think, extremely well for a first book by an English author, of which there are very few SF authors compared with the American SF authors. He sold more than some of our American authors. He has not sold anything like as well as our well-known American authors. But we were very pleased with the sale. We got quite a lot of publicity for it to help.
John, I believe, to justify your statement, Doubleday have taken it in America, have they?
They have.
Yeah. Which is an interesting thing because Doubleday's list is about 12 a year now and increasing.
John, 20.
20 a year now. How many
Harrisons?
Five. Bad average.
Now. would you say, Mr. Bush, that this was because of the review on this novel?
No, not wholly. Partly. It did have some. It had one or two poor reviews. It had one or two rather ecstatic ones. There is a basic number of books that a publisher will sell with any particular publisher's interest. The public and I think the trade know more or less what to expect. You will sell a basic number I think we should sell a basic number of any science fiction book we put out. We wouldn't sell the same number again if it was a rotten book as the next one. But we should sell that basic number. And over above that, the author's name with us counts more for sales than anything else at all. Very true. We publish four or five books now. We've only been doing it for 4 years. We publish four or five books by some of the well-known names. And they have varied in quality. They varied in the critical reception they've had. But their sales have been within a few hundred of each book. It's been pretty much the same. And I think the sales in this country do depend very much on the name of the
author. That's an answer to your question.
Yes, thank you, Ted.
We had a question. Just, yes.
What
publishers keep on sticking to these reviews on the front of their covers, and then sticking underneath something like the Stone of the World Gazette, which nobody's ever heard of.
Probably because the Star on the World Chronicle Gazette review is the only one who read it.
I was in the blur myself and signed the Queen.
Well, this comes back to a point we crossed not very long ago on American paperback reviews with brief comments, which are often used in our own book reviews here, because the publisher likes to give some form of criticism, good criticism, from the Saturday Evening Post or the New Yorker or the Gazette. And we do have the quips on the back of our jackets from America. And we have the interest.
The only reason to put those or any other reviews on a cover is to persuade the customer that since someone likes it, he probably will too. It doesn't much matter what name is signed to it. It's nice if you have a recognized reviewer whose name itself is recognizable. But it's not important. And the proof of this is in a book which Don Wolheim published, Carol Andra by C.S. Lewis, where the blurb he put at the cover was a quotation which said, as good as the best of Wells or Edgar Rice Burroughs, and it was signed D.A. Wolheim.
Yes, in the middle of the whole.
Why are British book publishers so slow in picking up Hugo winners and Hugo contenders?
Do you want to answer this, Mr. Matt?
Yeah, a little pleasure. Well, at least one reason for this is because American paperback houses, and I'm not going to in any way to be personal here, very frequently unload large quantities of their edition in the British Commonwealth. Now, they can't have their cake and eat it. I had a case not very long ago of a book which I bought, the hardback rights, and just 3 weeks before the book was due to be published here, something like, so far as we could find out, 20,000 copies in an American paperback came in. Every shop in the Charing Cross Road was full of it.
Don't you have any legal redress from the
past? You have a great deal of legal redress, but it goes on forever and ever and ever. And quite frankly, once the thing has been done, once the damage has been done, it's almost too late. You know, I've seen books which I've had on offer on my desk being sold in large quantities in this country. We know that there's enthusiasm, we know that the fans want to get hold of something which has just been awarded the Hugo and not published here yet, but it is a very serious one, and my God, it's serious for the author. In the long run, the author loses an enormous amount in this sort of work.
But coming back to this, the only two I can think of recently are your timeline collection, 6x8, which had a different title,
Unpleasant Professional Jonathan Hurley,
and the Golden Goblet, Gladiator of Law, which affected Gallant.
Yeah.
But I've not seen any of the Hugos. I've not seen large numbers of the Dick Hugo. Fritz Lieber's The Big Time took a long, long time to appear, and I've not seen any Americans of those except for QH collections, which aren't brought over in bulk.
If you're telling me that there are first-rate American books which have not appeared here at all, come and have 5 minutes with me afterwards, and I'd be delighted to write them down and buy you a whiskey. But if you're complaining that they take a long time after their appearance in America to come out here, that's an answer. Is that what you're really complaining about?
Yes, basically.
Well, it's just a question of organisation. Very often, and I rather regret this, I very much wish that there could be a far greater degree of liaison between American and British publishers in advance of the event, so to speak. But very often, the thing gets complicated, the issue gets a little bit blurred. You know, one has a mate in an American publishing house, and he says, we're doing a smashing book. And you say, right, I'd love to see it. He said, well, I can't send it to you direct because, of course, you know, this is handled by such and such an agent in New York. So you write to such and such an agent in New York. And he says, well, of course, I'm not handing this directly to UK. This is being handled by my agent in London. Well, you get on to the agent in London, who then comes back and says, well, I haven't received any copies yet, but I'll put your name on the list. Well, now, by the time it goes from the American publisher, it has now been published. It goes from the American publisher to his American agent, from the American agent to the English agent. I can see Mr. Clark down there grinning. You've had this one, have you? Yeah. Then it comes to the English publisher. The English publisher reads it. He says, yes, I want it. He draws up terms, or offers terms towards an agreement. This goes back through agent A, agent B, back to American publisher. Now, 3 months have gone by, 4 months have gone by, 5 months have gone by. You know, we're back and forwards across the Atlantic. Things which should have been sent by airmail, or somebody's 25 cents on instead of 75 cents, so it comes email, and another 3 weeks goes by. Finally, the thing is agreed. Then he starts to think about putting it in production. Well, most hardware, I can only talk as a hardware publisher here, although I think from the point of view of production, I think Tony and John will agree with me, generally speaking, 6 to 9 months is the minimum from the time that the thing is ready to go into production to the time that it actually sees the light of day in the bookshop. There's your 12 months, there's your 15 months. I regret it, but I'm afraid, you know, it is this inevitable organisation.
Is it, and I'll add an aside here, but I think that situation here...
Can I start in and say I wasn't in any way referring to my old friend John Carnell when I was talking about London agents? He's a homicide quicker than that,
the problem is narrowing now, but we have suffered rather badly from not only the time lag that Ron's speaking about, excuse me, but also because there were far fewer publishers here who were actively interested in science fiction, and that now the tempo is increasing with hardcover and paperback publishers taking science fiction, and a great deal of interest outside the recognised names. There will be the odd book, I'm sure, that will creep on a general list. This is science fiction. The gap will obviously narrow, but you can't overcome this particular time lag. You had a question on the end there.
Yes, regarding the sales of paperbacks in England, surely the only big publisher, the only big importer is Thornton Porter, who are not very good anyway, and these books only get distribution in London, and they're not seen in the other part of the country. Are your biggest sales in the London area, then, to account for this drop in sales through American paperbacks?
Thornton covers our country.
Yes, but they only seem to cover the London area. I mean, these books just aren't seen in North England, very many cases. I mail to North England, they're just never seen there.
Oh, well, one of the reasons they're not seen in North England, of course, is that W. H. Smith hardly exists in the North of England.
Yes, but
I can answer this one for you, in fact, because I do know the sales figures of practically all the American imported books into this country. And although it varies to a large extent between Valentine and Berkeley and Pyramid, they range from about 3,000 copies to an absolute maximum of 10, and I don't think anybody's any longer doing 10 with Thornton Porter. In fact, over the last few years, it has been impressed upon the American paperback publisher here that he's wasting his efforts trying to make a cent on shipping copies into this country. When you work out freight charges, 55% of the distributor, we assume that 2 or 3 cents is at least theoretically credited to the author on this sale. 3,000 or 4,000 copies doesn't mean a thing. He'd make more money taking 10% of an English sale than he would in all his hard work. But he has an answer that X thousand copies have to be printed to make it a commercial proposition in New York because the press needs so many, say 80,000 minimum or 50,000 minimum. The bigger the publishing house, the bigger the print order. And he doesn't sell all these. I'm not even inferring that he ships us over his unsold copies, because he doesn't. Very often, copies of American paperbacks are over here, as Ken Slater will know, within a few weeks of American publication. But they are a portion of the expected returns, and it helps the American paperback house to offload his minimum print number. So he's prepared to
interesting situation insofar as 2 or 3 years after a book has been published and forgotten here, and we can name quite a few good ones. Let's even go back to The Space Merchants, which recently came out in England, and in fact saw a hardcover edition in 1954.
I don't remember.
About the old the era of 8 or 10 publishers interested. And also saw a small paperback distribution. But Penguin Books could take this book 7 years later and build it into a very big seller and get a very good review. I think it's a specific case in point. It doesn't apply to every paperback, but it is applying more and more. It's a peculiar complex situation that is difficult to control because there are so many people involved and so many reasons.
We've heard a lot about these problems confronting the hardcover publication of light fiction, and we know that Penguin don't do educational stuff. Would the members of the panel like to give a date, and if so, what is the date for their last publication of a hardcover light fiction novel?
I think you should define light fiction.
Science fiction. And novels, apart from educational stuff.
You're saying, do we think that the days of the hardcover publication are,
well,
do you like novels at all?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Well, I don't think so.
Oh, not at all. I almost say the reverse, quite frankly, in a selective sort of way. Quite obviously, there will be an X number of science fiction novels published every year in this country. Then a certain proportion of them, probably a fairly high proportion of them, will go direct into paperback. But there's no doubt in my mind at all, and I'd be very interested to hear John Carnell as an agent's attitude on this one. But so far as really worthwhile writing in the field is concerned, and I think this is on the up, I think it's on the increase, I think it's getting to a wider field, it's getting more respectable, if you like, was the term used. And so that in the author's interest now, let's just think about the author's interest, just for a brief moment. Publication in hardback first, and in Penguin or Mayflower or NEL or any other afterwards, will yield the author more than direct paperback publication. Secondly, and I think this is true too, I think this has been established in fact, and again, I'd ask you maybe to comment on this, that if an author wants to build up a reputation in the literary field as a writer of something worthwhile, then hardback publication is very valuable. He gets more review space, the thing comes through the orthodox channels. Now, I know this doesn't apply in the United States. The situation in the United States is probably very different. But I think this is true, I'm wide open at the moment.
I didn't read it from that angle at all. I merely meant, is the hardcover book doomed?
No,
I don't think it's doomed. Or everything else?
No, I don't think it's doomed at all.
You don't?
No, it's not anymore.
One thing we've been operating for the last few years, that is with the death of the commercial library, which is the retail selling price of fiction particularly, is fixed at 13 and sixpence, and yes, 16 shillings. The economics of publishing hardcover books were controlled by that. Yes. Whereas now, you ignore that, it doesn't exist, you can price a book accordingly.
Yeah, I think, yes, if I may just very briefly come back on that one, you said what I should have said, and that is that if you're going to go, we're going to go on having books published in hardback first, then we've just got to have much higher prices. They are creeping up very substantially, but the day of the 30 shilling, 35 shilling, 2 guinea novel is not very far away.
And you still think they won't kill it?
People
won't wait for the body book?
No.
I don't know, probably going to book this autumn, I think, at 63 shilling a novel.
People pay £2 for a gramophone record. There's no reason why they shouldn't pay 30 shillings for a worthwhile piece.
Well, they can't get that gramophone record later on. For 3 and 6.
Well, the same thing applies. People make up the Capricorn is almost gone in this country. Hardly exists.
I didn't say 3 and 6.
No, 2 and 6 is gone. It's disappeared.
The answer, Ken, there is that in the middle 1950s when we had a spate of
over several years, and they bought ahead. Not many of them made the 2000, and this is one of the reasons why we had this very quick decline between from 1955 onwards. But people like Faber and the better publishers who've been in had established lists before, and they weathered the storm. Now the situation now, where you have an 18-6, 21 shillings book, is that the break-even figure is not much higher, but the sales are very much higher. So although the profit ratio is probably smaller, they still are making money on science fiction, and in the 1950s they weren't. And sales are now going to libraries, and libraries are very high now. This comes back to the death of the old Sutney Library.
Differences between hardback publishing and paperback publishing. Could somebody clarify these differences and the difficulties in the two?
As far as what's concerned,
well,
the actual method of putting a book through production.
Well, yeah. Well, it's something to do with the two cultures.
Basically, I think that they had the same problems as to how many presses can be used to print how many books in what length of time, but you still have a production deadline and a production period of time where the book is going through the various channels, and you just can't move it within a certain bracket. It has to take its time. Whether a hardcover publisher can, on a rare occasion, get a book out very, very quickly, and so can a paperback publisher, this can't apply to all the books they handle. I think
I think what he's really asking is, what makes a successful paperback as opposed to what makes a successful publication of a book by yourself, say?
Is that what you're asking?
Something similar. I'm getting at the sort of basic thing that books come in hardback and then are sold to paperback houses, or...?
Well, no, before somebody said something about that paperbacks no longer have the old-fashioned methods of distribution as the hardback.
Well, one of the states is that you're going to sell, say, 25,000 copies of a book, as opposed to trying to sell 3,000 copies of a book. You're obviously going to meet buyers who are more buyers for a start, and there aren't many good buyers in the book trade, certainly not in paperbacks, which means that you're trying to call the people who are non-discriminating themselves. This is one of our big problems in paperbacks. We were using the old methods. We were trying to sell some man in W.H. Smith branch in Northampton who had begun life as a packer or something, and had stayed a packer virtually, but in fact was now the area manager or something. So how do you sell this man books? He doesn't even read books. As opposed to, say, you're dealing with a more sophisticated buyer who probably will send a proof copy to him and he'll read the book, and he'll base his offer for the book upon his own judgment as you'll base your print model on your own judgment. This doesn't happen in paperbacks at all, and until we go over that hump into a situation which we virtually have to publish and decide how many books they're going to have, we couldn't really move.
One other perhaps important basic difference here is that a large proportion of the hardback edition is going to go to libraries, public libraries. Ted Carnell was talking about the demise of the old Tutney Library, the circulating library, Smith's Libraries, Boots Libraries, Westminster Libraries, Chain Libraries, all these sort of people. This is true, these have gone, because on the whole, the people that pay their tuppence or fourpence a week to read their Western or their Thriller or whatever, now watch the play on Channel 9 instead. But, or they buy a paperback. Fair enough, the public libraries in the last few years, in this country, and to a lesser extent in the Commonwealth, but nevertheless to an important extent, have been getting better and better and better. Public library service in this country is first rate now. Now, a large proportion of a hardback edition goes through those channels. No proportion, or virtually no proportion, of a paperback edition goes through those channels. In order to get through those channels, we go what he describes as the more sophisticated bookshop. He goes to the wholesaler, the newsagent wholesaler, to the newsagent on the street corner, or the lesser Smith's bookshop, and the bigger Smith's bookshop too. But a much wider field.
Yes,
I'd
like to call how this distribution of most of the hardbacks in the library compared to the States. Do you need more to do that?
put it that way.
I was very interested to listen because I was not too familiar with the way it looks over here. In the United States, the hardbacks are very largely designed for libraries, public, free public libraries, and also circulating libraries, which seem to have persisted in the States somehow. A couple of years ago, when Ballantyne was publishing simultaneous hard and soft cover books, I very often would see people carrying around circulating copies of a hardcover book, which they must have spent 40 cents to rent, and they could have owned it for 35, but they just didn't want to own a book. I guess they didn't want to build bookcases, or didn't want to be troubled dusting them. But these do exist, and I think that at least half of the editions of most hardcover books, bestsellers aside, do go into some form of library.
There's one big fundamental difference between the American market and the British market on this, is that we, by agreement, do not sell direct to public libraries, whereas in America, American publishers do sell direct to public libraries. We sell through booksellers.
Tony Richards.
Yeah, I only wanted to say really that with a hardback, we've got a very different category of audience, and in fact, the buying habits are radically different from those which apply to the paperback. If you're marketing a paperback, you can, I should think, allow a major part of your audience to be spec buyers, people who don't have much time to spend choosing a book, who perhaps aren't always particularly particular about what book they would take on a journey or something like this. In other words, your marketing procedure is thoroughly different. You have to hit them rather hard than a hardback does. The hardback publisher, I think, Ron would agree, that a hardback public is a rather specialized thing. Where people perhaps who take a greater degree of pride in their books than people who buy paperbacks. They take more time choosing them. They probably buy more systematically and methodically.
They may even read reviews.
Yeah, they may even read reviews. But this means that, in fact, the whole publishing operation is radically different, and that packaging is important to a paperback in a way which simply really doesn't apply to a hardback. Which leads me to wonder whether anyone has any comments to make actually on science fiction graphics, because I know we have no specialists here, but the fact that they should mostly be so awful is something which intrigues me. I wonder whether this is really just in relation to a lot of people buying them.
Another thing that I think has a good deal to do with the value of the standards of the hardcover publisher in the States, at least, is that the hardcover publisher receives half the fee the paperback publisher pays for the use of the book. And in many cases, he won't buy a book unless he can sell it to the paperback publisher, which tends to, I think, lower the standards that might otherwise apply. Make the hardcover publisher consider whether 80,000 people will want paperback edition. So it sort of levels it out.
We have another question in. We're down to the last 5 minutes. Sorry, do you mind just pick on your new question?
Yes, arising out of Mr. Richardson's remark, I was going to ask who is responsible, in fact, for the paperback covers? I mean, just as a general question.
Yes. Well, I mean, you have an art department which is fundamentally responsible. Ultimately, the decision as to how you treat a book in paperback is a combined editorial and sales decision. I ask this question fundamentally because the style of our own paperbacks is curiously irrelevant in the sense that we have made it a habit in the past to use details from surrealist paintings whose connection with the content of the book. The specific content of the book is very nebulous indeed. Yet, we have got an extraordinarily positive response from the people who actually sell the books about these covers, saying how good they are. And also, in fact, our sales seem to be very good. Now, this is so much at odds with sort of standard graphics. I'm not thinking here particularly of paperback so much, should we say, as a magazine illustration. Certainly some paperbacks, which sometimes tend to vulgarize, sometimes tend to put very sexy images rather inappropriately on covers. I don't know what it is, maybe we have a different market. But why is it that really the standard of craftsmanship, the standard of imagination in science fiction illustration is so appalling?
Last question. I wonder
if I might pursue this and ask Mr. Poe a question arising out of a series of paperbacks bought by Thorpe and Porter and presumably an importer to this country that way, the Beacon Galaxy novel selection, arising out of this point of graphics and...
Could you have found some other question to ask?
How, in fact, does this arise? I mean, is it merely a matter of economics from the point of view of Galaxy publishing, selling to a paperback, people who want to market it in their own way, or did you have any say, or...
You said it exactly right. This was a case where the paperback people, the Beacon Publishing, remember their title, came to Galaxy some years ago with a proposal. They said, let us have some science fiction novels and let us package them our own way because you won't like the way we do it. And we didn't. and we guarantee you large sales and you will all be very rich. Well, it didn't happen the way they said. We didn't get very rich, and I've been plagued by the things ever since. This was an attempt to capitalize on the lustful impulses of American youth, as far as I can tell. They were meant to look like much sexier novels than any of them really were. And they had on them the sort of cover that Harry Harrison described as Don Walheim using a little while ago, the naked girl being clutched by a monster. And it just didn't work for us. I don't know how well it worked for Don.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm sorry to bring this to a conclusion now. The idea of the exercise is to keep the hall at least half filled for 2 hours, while those who liked an early dinner went out and came back again, and those who liked a late one came in to start with and subsequently went out. But to the benefit of those of us who are still here and haven't eaten yet, we're closing down at 8 o'clock. It was called From the Cradle to the Consumer, or From Conception to Consumption. And if Ken Slater had been with us, we should have called it From the Cradle to the